Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavam Cha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Samsajivam Sadvoitam Sadvadutam Paritana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitam Cha Panchakalpa Trubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyeva Cha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
November 16th, 2015, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 7, further inquiries by Vidura, text 22. Srisvagre Maharadini. Savikaranyanukramat
Savikaranyanukramat
Tevyo virajam udritya
Tevyo virajam udritya
Tamanu pravishad vibhu Mahat Adini, the total material energy. Savikarani, along with the sense organs. Anukramat, by a gradual process of differentiation. Tebhyaha, out of that. Virajam, the gigantic universal form. Udritya, manifesting. Tam, unto that. Anu, later. Pravishat, entered. Vibhu, the supreme. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. After creating the total material energy, the Mahatattva, and thereby manifesting the gigantic universal form with senses and sense organs, the Supreme Lord entered within it. Purport. Fully satisfied by the answers of the sage Maitreya, Vidura wanted to understand the remaining portions of the creative function of the Lord, and he took the clue from the previous topics. Srisvagre Mahadadini Swavikara Nyanukramat Tebhyo Vira Jamudritya Tam Manu Pravishad Vibhu. After creating the total material energy, the Mahatattva, and thereby manifesting the gigantic universal form with senses and sense organs, the Supreme Lord entered within it. Interesting that Vibhu here is used as it usually is to indicate the Lord, whereas in a previous verse it was used to refer to Maitreya. So Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, in commenting on this particular verse, says that out of joy of achieving satisfaction, Vidura repeats what Maitreya said in order to ask details of the pastimes just heard, as Prabhupada says, being satisfied, fully satisfied. Now Vidura wants to know more details. So he has joy and he wants more. And this is our evidence of advancement in spiritual life, one of our evidences. Srila Prabhupada said that when we advance in spiritual life, we don't need to take a certificate from others. So we may get a certificate from others, you've passed your Bhakti Shastri degree, but that certificate doesn't tell whether or not we're becoming more Krishna conscious. How do we tell whether or not we're becoming more Krishna conscious? What's our evidence procedure? And Srila Prabhupada compares it to eating, because that's a verse in the Bhagavatam that when you eat, you get nourishment, you get relief from hunger, and you get pleasure. So you don't need any certificate from others. You know, yesterday we had a wonderful program for Srila Prabhupada's disappearance day, and so many devotees brought so many food preparations offered to Srila Prabhupada. And you didn't need to ask anybody after the feast, you know, did I eat enough? You know that you feel satisfied, you feel nourished, you feel joyful. Oh, what a wonderful feast. You don't need to ask anybody else if you slept enough. And these are our own self-evident procedures. It's not a question of a certificate from others. And we have to know these self-evident procedures. We have to know what are the symptoms of advancement in Krishna consciousness. First of all, we should know these symptoms, as we're talking about here today, for ourselves. But also we should know these symptoms as far as choosing our association, choosing a spiritual master, and so forth. In fact, Arjuna asks in the Bhagavad Gita in several places, what are these symptoms? He asks in the second chapter, what are the symptoms? How does he speak? What is his language? How does he sit? How does he walk? He asks again in the 14th chapter, what are the symptoms of one who has thus transcended the modes of material nature. And how does he transcend the modes of material nature? And of course, Krishna throughout the Bhagavad Gita, especially in some places in the Divine and Demoniac Natures, chapter 16, text 1 through 3, Krishna is giving the symptoms of the divine qualities. At the end of chapter 12, text 13 through 20, Krishna is also giving the symptoms of a devotee who's very dear to him. In the Bhagavatam, Lord Kapiladev, and then again in the 11th canto, is giving the 26 qualities of a devotee. These are also repeated by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to Sanatana Goswami. We also find Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu giving the 9 symptoms of bhava to Sanatana Goswami. So this concept that there should be symptoms of spiritual advancement is extremely important. We have to know what are the right symptoms. What should we be looking for? How can we tell that we're making progress? And such symptoms, or they call it out in the world, benchmarks, are an important part of any endeavor. You know, if you're going to be learning a foreign language, how do you tell you're learning the language? If you're learning mathematics, how do you tell that you're learning mathematics? If you're learning how to drive, I gave my grandson a driving lesson yesterday on a manual stick shift. How do you know that you're learning how to drive? How do you know? Because if you don't know the symptoms, there's several problems. I mean, one problem is that you can think you're not making any advancement when you are. You can think, well, you know, I've been practicing this Krishna consciousness already for 10 years or 20 years, and it doesn't work. You know, you don't know what to look for. And another problem can be that if you're not making any advancement, if there's some problem, then you don't notice it. If you're looking at the wrong symptoms, then you can think you're advancing when you're not. And in the Krishna Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami, especially there, gets into detail about the symptoms of not making advancement. And it's entirely possible. It's entirely possible for a person to be in a spiritual practice and not be attaining spirituality. It's completely possible. Because we're not talking about a mechanical process. We're talking about a loving relationship between a person, the soul, and the Supreme Person, Krishna. And just like people can be in a relationship with another human being, but not have any kind of real connection with them. Happens all the time. A person can be going to school and not learning much of anything. I mean, I used to get, when I ran a school, I would get students who came from other schools, and sometimes they didn't know anything. I mean, I remember getting one kid like that, and I said, did you always sit in the back of the room? And the teacher just didn't notice you. And I think religion has a bad name often in the world because of the religious adherents who don't really make much genuine spiritual progress. Either they're just at the beginning of spiritual life, or they just don't make much progress. And people say, oh, you know, religious people can be more intolerant and violent and so forth than anybody else. I don't think that's a true statement. But we can find that even in religious organizations, there are people who, either they're just not progressing or their progress is so slow that they're pretty much indistinguishable from materialistic persons, except that they couch the language of their life in religious terms. So here's one of the primary symptoms. There's many symptoms of advancement in spiritual life. As we listed all the different places in the Shastra where one can find them. So today we're looking at one in particular, this eagerness to hear more, eagerness to want more, the joyful eagerness to want more, what we often call a taste, param drishtva nivartite. Yesterday I was listening to some of Prabhupada's lectures on nectar devotion, and he was specifically talking about taste. He was talking about taste as a definition of rasa. Now, one of the ways we can translate the word rasa is taste. So, what do we mean by having a taste for something? You know, in English, the word means something that I enjoy, something that gives me pleasure. A person has a taste for certain kinds of food and not for other kinds of food. One person loves potatoes and another person hates them. One person likes, you know, opera and another person doesn't. And we have our individual tastes as a manifestation of our personality. It's one of the markers of personality. What do we like? What do we not like? We can also explain taste as the sensation, the sense sensation that we get specifically on the tongue from certain kinds of food, the particular kind of enjoyment. And there's different kinds of enjoyments from different kinds of food. You know, there's one kind of enjoyment from sweets and another kind of enjoyment from bitter and so forth. At our feast yesterday, we had some very strong tasting mango, eggplant pickles. And the taste was quite different from the kachoris, the Urd Dal kachoris, and that was quite different from the pineapple upside down cake and so forth. So the different taste sensations, the varieties of taste sensations. And we can also explain taste as here, this joy, this eagerness to want more and more, that I like something so much that it's hard to get enough. Right? And it's a natural tendency to enjoy something so much that you want more and more and more. We're going to look at that briefly, and then we're going to look at the specific evidence of spiritual taste, and then we're going to look at how do we get spiritual taste. So this natural tendency to want more and more, it's coming from the soul. It's coming from the soul. This is not something that is just simply mundane. The impersonalists say that the natural state of the soul is just simply equilibrium, just to be merged into the Brahman. Naso chati na kanchati. They end there. Right? They don't go to the rest of the verse. And they just look at the verses that talk about not caring about joy and grief and pleasure and pain, etc. And they just see this as a state of neutrality. But we can see that the material activities are perverted reflections of the spiritual. That's our personalistic conception. The impersonalists take it that our material desires to have a taste, to have enjoyment, and to have more and more and more are simply the result of illusion, and that we should stop that completely. And the spiritualists see it as a perverted reflection, as Srila Prabhupada liked to call it, the upside-down banyan tree that is mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. As above, so below. So this natural tendency to want to hear more and more and more, you know, we see this in the modern entertainment society, that people, they make a movie about something, they make a movie about Superman, and then they have to make another movie and another movie and another movie, or the TV shows that go on week after week after week, and people always want to hear more. You know, I remember when I was a kid, Batman was very popular, and I tried watching a few episodes, but I never could understand why it was so popular. And people, you know, always wanting to hear more and more and more. What's Batman doing today? And of course, he was always doing the same kind of thing. Or with books, you know, the Hardy Boys mysteries and the Nancy Drew mysteries and more books, the Harry Potter books, right? There was book one and book two and book three. Let me hear more and more and more about them. And there are even societies that really get into these things. You know, there's the Tolkien Lord of the Rings Society and the Shakespeare Society. And, you know, the books have a limit. There's an end to the books. But then the people who really get into it, they go into more detail. And they discuss all the different parts of these imaginary worlds, or with real people, people who want to hear more and more and more about this celebrity or that celebrity. And when there's nothing to hear, they make up news. You know, I was at the dentist the other day, and they had one of these scandal sheets. And just the cover was just some lies about some celebrity. And I said to the receptionist, you know, why do you have to carry this? So as soon as we walk in the door, oh, this is the first thing that we see. If they have nothing to say, they make up something just because they want to hear more and more and more. And of course, ultimately, we want to hear and chant more and more and more about ourselves. So most conditioned souls are constantly trying to find somebody who's willing to listen to and relish their own activities. Right? They write about their own activities. Nowadays, you blog about them, you tweet about them, you Facebook about them, you take a picture of yourself at 10,000 times during the day that you upload, and you see how many people are following me, how many people are keeping up with every detail of my daily activity. So this is the main thing that we want to hear and chant more and more about is ourself, but we also have this strong tendency to hear and chant about others. So we may be talking about what our family members are doing or what the co-workers are doing. And it's never ending. It's never ending. Of course, the problem is that materially, it's also not very satisfying. It's not that after hearing and chanting about people's mundane activities, whether our own or others, that then we feel joyful. But there's certainly evidence that we are looking for this spiritual joy. So this is a natural tendency. Some people think, you know, again, that spiritual life means I withdraw from everything and I just go into nothing. But in Krishna consciousness, we take this natural tendency and we use it for the real. We use it for Krishna. We don't deny it. We don't deny it. We don't say, don't hear and chant about anything. Just become silent. Just retire somewhere away from the crowd. Of course, there's that tendency also for liberation, isn't there? Because our hearing and chanting about mundane things isn't satisfying. Therefore, we think, oh, let me hear nothing anymore. But that doesn't last. So the evidence of having spiritual taste is that we have the same eagerness to hear and chant about Krishna and Krishna's devotees as ordinary materialists have for their mundane topics. You know, that I remember when Prabhupada was on the planet and he was translating, you know, and we would get the books as Prabhupada would translate them, and we were so eager. What's the next book that's coming out? What's the next book? Or the next recording, you know, we were getting the cassette tapes as Srila Prabhupada was speaking them. Well, what did Prabhupada say now? What did Prabhupada say now? So eager. And this is the mood that the devotee should have, that they can't wait to hear more and more and more. You know, we're very fortunate that devotees are busy translating so many of the books of our acharyas and of the Goswamis. Practically speaking, now there's so many books that it'd be difficult to read them all in one lifetime. Indeed, I know many people, including myself, who have a collection of books that there's no possibility that they're ever going to read before they leave this planet. So this is one symptom of eagerness. That, oh, what does the acharya say? Right? What more is Srila Prabhupada saying? And not only something new, but to rehear the old. Just like, again, in the material world, there are people who they see the same movie 20 times. Of course, you know, you can't see the same movie every day forever. Perhaps there's some aficionados who do that. But an evidence of spiritual taste is that we can hear the same pastime over and over again. And I think all of us have experienced that the books, the stories, they retain some new taste. You find something new in them. It happens practically on a daily basis. Someone the other day sent me an excerpt from one of Srila Prabhupada's lectures on the Ishopanishad, and I thought, I've heard this lecture many times before, and somehow I didn't hear this part of it. I didn't really understand this thing that Srila Prabhupada was saying. And we can understand, I don't really understand it now. There's deeper and deeper layers of meaning. So to always want to hear more in the sense of new, and to always want to hear more in the sense of repeated hearing. It's interesting in the Jiva Goswami's book, Gopal Champu, he has the story takes place in Vrindavan with these two reciters are telling all of Krishna's pastimes, both in and out of Vrindavan. And of course, the residents of Vrindavan directly experienced Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan, and they heard about Krishna's pastimes in Mathura and Dwarka. In fact, it's explained that there were messengers going back and forth constantly. They didn't have internet in those days, but there were messengers going back and forth all the time to Mathura and later to Dwarka. So the people were hearing about this at the time. At the time that it was happening, they were hearing about it or they were involved in it. And yet, when it's being told to them again, they're so eager. And the most often repeated phrase in Gopal Champu is, and then? And then what happened? And then what happened? As if they hadn't heard it before. Always fresh. Always fresh. It says sometimes Srimati Radharani, when she sees Krishna, she says, who is that wonderful boy? And her friends say, you saw him just earlier today. Oh, I did? You're joking with me. I've never seen him before. So this Navayovanam cha, Krishna's Navayovanam not only in the sense that he's eternally youthful, but also in the sense that everything about him is always fresh and new. So some evidence of spiritual taste is that we're experiencing this eagerness for new in terms of more. What does this acharya say? What does this Goswami say? and that we always want to hear the pastimes again and again. We don't say, oh, I already read the Bhagavad Gita. You know, I already read the Ishopanishad. And just recently, I completed reading the teachings of Lord Chaitanya, and I'm a little embarrassed to admit that I hadn't read it since before I moved into the temple. You know, Chaitanya Charitamrita came out, and I read that over and over again, and then there was, of course, Chaitanya Bhagavat and Chaitanya Mangala, and I hadn't gone back to the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. And somehow I decided to reread that book, and wow, what an incredible book. I mean, every couple days I was finding some quote from it to share with my friends. So this is what we should be experiencing. That it's not some sort of a drudgery, it's not some sort of an obligation. Oh, it's time for me to do my daily reading. But it should be something that we look forward to. At the end of the day, if we think about, well, how much did I hear, how much did I read, we should never think, oh, well, that was enough. That was enough. And the same with all of our services. Like Prabhupada was asked, how do we know we have good quality japa? And he said, when 16 rounds isn't enough, when you want to chant 16,000 rounds. So if we have some, oh, finally, I finally finished my rounds. Now let me put my bead bag down and now I can do what I want to do. I finished my obligation versus, oh, with regret. Now I have to put down my beads. Well, I can keep chanting while I'm doing other things. And this is an evidence of taste. Or why does the kirtan have to end? Why can't it keep going on and on and on? I got an email from someone recently who said, every time I listen to a Bhagavatam class, I wish it wouldn't end. And with deity worship, you know, worshiping the deity, and, oh, you know, isn't there something further I could do? Could I do more decoration of the altar? Could I do more decoration of the deity? Why does it have to end? Why does it have to end? Whatever service it may be, why does my time in the Holy Dham have to end? Why does this meeting with devotees have to end? Why can't I get more and more and more? So whatever area of Krishna consciousness, whether it's hearing, whether it's chanting, whether it's serving the deities, whether it's serving the devotees, we will note, however, Srila Prabhupada makes this point in the Nectar Devotion, that each of us will have a different areas of Krishna consciousness that we particularly relish. Now, one might say, well, this preference for some areas over other is simply due to the particular conditioning of the modes of material nature that we have, and we shouldn't indulge in such partiality. And to some extent, it's a fact that in the beginning of Krishna consciousness, our attraction to certain parts of Krishna consciousness are going to be more by our modes of material nature. I mean, after all, in material life, why did someone else like Batman and I didn't? It was simply that my particular combination of the modes that are covering me is different from someone else's combination of the modes. You know, one person likes potatoes and one person likes tomatoes because of the particular modes that cover them. Just like the pig, as Prabhupada will often say, it likes to eat garbage, it likes to eat excrement, and it doesn't like to eat halva. Right? You have some ants that like sugar and some ants that like protein. So this is just according to the modes of material nature. So that may be true in the beginning of Krishna consciousness, but even then, Srila Prabhupada encouraged even beginners, just like our godbrother Brahmatirtha, who was at that time Bob Cohen, and Prabhupada said, you may eat the prasadam that you particularly enjoy. He says the great devotees will relish anything, but you can eat what you particularly enjoy. So that allowance is there. We need to allow ourselves, not just allow ourselves, we need to relish the fact that Krishna has so much individuality and variety. No two leaves on the same tree are the same. No two apples on the same tree are the same. So even on the material level, there's varieties. And as Yukta Vairagya, we can engage our varieties in Krishna's service. Of course, Srila Prabhupada gave a minimum for everyone, a minimum of 16 rounds, minimum of studying the Shastra every day, worshipping the deity every day. That should be done by everybody. But as far as going deeper, that should be according to one's taste. And of course, as one progresses in Krishna consciousness, the particular taste that one has becomes more and more a function of the spiritual individuality rather than the mundane individuality. the aspects of the mundane individuality start to decrease as the coverings of the modes of material nature decrease. Now, it's explained very nicely by our acharyas that once our individual, specific, eternal taste for Krishna starts to awaken, that we should be careful to take up the angas of bhakti that nourish that taste. And there are, it's explained that there are angas that strongly nourish it, that somewhat nourish it, that are neutral, that are somewhat opposed, and that are strongly opposed. Still, Prabhupada says we do not reject the drop. So we find that the residents of Vrindavan, they're also hearing about Krishna marrying Rukmini, they're hearing about Krishna fighting with Shalva. It's not that they don't hear about these things. They hear about the different incarnations of Krishna. They hear about Krishna as Ramchandra. They hear about Krishna as Nrsingadeva. They're telling these stories to Krishna, and Krishna's also relishing them. So even the gopis of Vrindavan, they're speaking about Krishna and his different incarnations. They're speaking about Krishna and Dwarka and so forth. But they particularly are engaged in meditating on Krishna's lila with them in their particular mood. So that's what they're especially relishing. So as one advances in Krishna consciousness, one especially relishes the activities of Krishna that is in one's particular mood. Although one doesn't reject anything else. One evidence of cheating advancement is that one becomes like the sahajiyas who only want to hear the Rasa-lila and don't want to hear anything else. Now, this spiritual taste generally is gradual and proportional. So as we get a spiritual taste, our material taste decreases. And another evidence procedure for advancement is not only that we're very attracted to Krishna, but that our attraction for things that take us away from Krishna is diminishing. And of course, again, this depends on our particular conditioned nature. So I think each of us will have the experience that certain attractions diminish almost immediately and completely. Just like many, many people who take to Krishna consciousness who were formerly meat eaters find themselves immediately and completely losing all of their taste and interest in meat, fish, and eggs. And other people I've seen take years. I know this one initiated devotee that he said after his wife got interested in Krishna consciousness, it was 2 years before he became a vegetarian. Whereas for other people, it's 2 seconds. So what particular thing we immediately lose taste for is going to vary by our individual attachments. And certain things are going to hang on in different people. And it'll be different in different people. You know, what we're particularly attached to. So the attachments, the material attachments and material taste that I still have may be things that you rejected long ago, and the material taste that you still have may be things that, you know, I rejected long ago. It may be things that we didn't have in this life altogether. I know one devotee who struggles with gambling, and other people never had any attraction to gambling at any point in their life. Our evidence is that we're developing material detachment, and we should see that that is increasing. We should see that we are gradually becoming more and more detached from material things. So there's gross material things, illicit sex, intoxication, meat eating, and gambling. And then there's the subtle material things. Pride, arrogance, envy, anger. You know, at first when you take up Krishna consciousness, one doesn't even know generally that one has these faults. We generally just think that we're nice people, and a symptom of our advancement is that we start to see these faults and that we start to find them disgusting. That we become revolted at these and we just say, I'm not going to do this. Just like Rupa Goswami says that the Uttama Bhakta has no propensity in their heart for criticizing others. They don't make a room for it in their heart. So these also, we should see the subtle anartas also disappearing. It's significant in this respect that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu does 2 cleanings of the Gundicha temple, which is the removal of anartas. One is of the gross dirt and one is of the fine dirt. So when one gets rid of the gross dirt, it can be understood that one has attained the stage of steadiness where 50% of the anartas are removed and one starts becoming happy. Here Vidura is happy. One starts becoming happy because the mode of goodness has taken over much of one's life. And then at that point, one is starting to deal with the subtle attachments, the cheating, the deceit, the fault-finding. And you'll see that when devotees hit this stage, they stop wanting to engage in activities of useless fault-finding and criticism. They don't want to join factions, as Prabhupada explains in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. They're carefree because they don't join any particular group. So there's one group screaming, oh, this Acharya says like this. And another group is saying, oh, this Acharya says like this. And you're not following the Siddhanta. And you're not following the Siddhanta. And you're, you know, on these petty things. And one gives up this desire to get in this kind of ego battle, and et cetera, et cetera. So these are the evidences we should see on the positive side, going towards Krishna, and on the negative side, becoming more and more disgusted. And these are gradual, these are proportional, and these are individual. They're gradual, they're proportional, and they're individual. And the fact that we notice in our life that we're still struggling with certain material tastes doesn't mean that we haven't made any advancement. We should look and see, okay, what things was I attached to 10 years ago that now I've given up, that now I have no more taste for? That if somebody, you know, offered me anything to take it up again, I would not do it. And this, we can find this as evidence of our advancement. So how do we do this? How do we get a taste for Krishna consciousness? Well, I think this is an answer that probably everybody listening to this class already knows, so I won't spend a whole lot of time on this. But mostly we get it through the association of the devotees and the association of Krishna himself. When we're in the sun, the darkness goes away. The darkness is revealed for what it is. And the sun, the warm sunshine, I suppose if it's May in India, it's not like that. But anyway, the warm sunshine is inviting and the darkness becomes revolting. So as we come closer and closer to Krishna as the Vishaya, and as we come closer and closer to the devotees as the Ashraya, then that acts as vibhav. It acts as a stimulus for our taste. And anything, of course, the Udipans, anything in relationship with Krishna. So just like if you have a child who's a picky eater, what do? You expose them to different foods. Try this, try this. So we want to expose ourselves to Krishna. Krishna is the all-attractive. Krishna is the all-attractive. And we want to put ourselves as close to Krishna and Krishna's devotees as we possibly can. And of course, we put ourselves close to Krishna and Krishna's devotees in so many ways. Again, we have our standard ways for everyone and according to our particular interests. So we have in the Bhagavatam and the Chaitanya Charitamrita, so many other literatures, we have descriptions of Krishna and his devotees. And one should start to feel that one's getting to know them. One should start to feel, oh, I'm getting to know Mother Yasoda, Mother Rohini, I'm getting to know Radharani, Lalita, and so forth. I'm getting to know Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his associates, Damodar Pandit, Jagadananda, Gadadhar Pandit. What is their mood? You know, we to get this sense that we get close to Krishna and his devotees. And of course, we're very fortunate that Srila Prabhupada and so many of his followers in many ways, they've created so many societies of devotees. There are so many big societies of devotees, and within those big societies, there are smaller sanghas of devotees. And we can certainly find some sangha that nourishes us. As Srila Prabhupada wrote to Jamuna and Dinatarani, he said, if you have two people that are compatible, you can make all advancement. And if you have 200 that are not compatible, nobody can make any advancement. So we need to find the sangha of devotees, even if it's just one person with whom we feel compatible. And that is true in our in this life, and that is true also in the eternal realm. And we do everything to get this taste. That should be our motive. Our motive should not be that we're engaging in devotional service to impress others with how advanced we are, how strict we are, or to gain our own pride, you know, with what a good devotee I am, or so we can know the trivia of the scriptures, which is an interesting thing because the scriptures don't seem, the writers and speakers of the scriptures don't seem to be at all concerned with the trivia of historical accuracy. So we can become, you know, a trivia expert in the scriptures and create exams and pass them on all of this trivia. But we can also read to relish. We can read, we can hear, we can chant our japa for this taste. We can go to the kirtan to develop this taste. We can be with other devotees to this taste, cook in the kitchen for this taste. Now, sometimes we see devotees, you know, they work really, 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 really hard to put on some festival, you know, and they're putting in so many hours, so many extra work, and at the end they're just tired and depressed. So that's missing the whole point. And in fact, if one goes on just superficially, then as Jiva Goswami explains in Bhakti Siddhartha, if one goes on just superficially, then there will be problems. One will start becoming deceitful. One will start becoming a cheater. And not only will one get a cheater, become a cheater, but one will use as evidence procedures for their advancements things that are not given in the Shastra. You know, I know of one devotee who's making a career. Actually, I have several devotees who do this, but one in particular comes to mind, of a devotee who's making a career out of blaspheming other devotees. And literally blasphemy, that he makes up lies about other devotees, and then he writes papers and creates videos of these lies. He knows they're lies. If you ask him, he say, "Oh, I'm just trying to be funny." And his temple presidents, GBC, his spiritual master, have all asked him to stop, and he says, "No, I'm so devoted to restoring purity in the society of devotees that I'm willing to disregard all of the instructions of my authorities and go on, you know, making this propaganda against these devotees who are preaching the wrong thing." So this is the kind of behavior that will happen when one engages in Krishna's consciousness without a desire for taste, without a desire to relish, without any, you know, emotional involvement. The main ways, and we talk about this a lot, to get this taste for Krishna and this detachment from Maya is to engage our emotions, our desire, and our identity. Yesterday I read something from Mahatma Prabhu where he said, whatever we put after the words "I am" is what is creating our reality, whatever we are telling ourselves, "I am." And the "I am" should be Chaitanya Radhasa Mui, Chaitanya Radhasa, Chaitanya Radhasa Mui, Chandra Dasara Das, Jivara Sarupaya Krishna Nitra Das, Ekala Ishwar Krishna, Arya Sarva, Vritya. I am Krishna's servant. I am the servant of the devotees. As such is a reason that we use the word Prabhu, which somehow morphed, as language does, into meaning human beings in male bodies. But the idea that we use the word Prabhu is, you know, dear Prabhu, your servant. So this is the sandwich. We start off with my dear Prabhu, and we end with, I am your servant. So this identity that I am Krishna's servant, and this emotions and this desires, that will help us to achieve this taste for Krishna consciousness. And that should be our goal. How much are we relishing Krishna consciousness? How much are we finding Krishna attractive? That should be the impetus for what we're doing, and it should be the evidence for whether or not we're doing it right. So, questions and comments?
Hare Krishna.
Yes, Hare Krishna.
I was curious, you mentioned that that we should find compatible association to make advancement. Yes. That Prabhupada told Jadurani and somebody else.
Jamuna and Dinatarni.
Oh, Jamuna and Dinatarni. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Sometimes we're put in situations in which, like, I have a friend in the Brahmacharya Ashram in San Diego who feels that it's very incompatible for him. But he's been instructed by his Guru Maharaj and the authorities there that he should stay in that Brahmacharya Ashram. And I didn't really have any advice for him. I said, well, if you have your Guru Maharaj's instruction, then you can't really do much about that. But he feels that the association there is making him frustrated and not able to make advancement properly. And so I was thinking about that, and I wasn't sure how much the association mattered as much as just your dedication to following the instructions or what the priority list was.
Well, I think all of us have situations where we have some incompatible association that's thrust upon us, at least at certain times in our life. sometimes it's a family member that you can't get rid of. You know, sometimes it's not some authority's order where perhaps you could blame the authority. Sometimes, you know, it's your kid. I mean, maybe you can divorce your spouse, but you're not going to divorce your, you know, 8-year-old kid. Sometimes it's the, you know, person you're working with at your job. You know, there's going to be people in our lives who make Krishna consciousness difficult. I don't see that can be entirely avoided. And how we deal with those people is also really, how do we say? We can use it as a chance to grow. We can use it as a chance to develop qualities that we didn't already have. You know, there's a very nice section here. Thomas A. Kempis, who was a 13th century monk, he gives some very nice things in this regard. He says, in his book, Imitation of Christ, he says, it is no great thing to associate with the good and gentle, for such association is naturally pleasing. Everyone enjoys a peaceful life and prefers persons of congenial habits. But to be able to live at peace with harsh and difficult men, or with the undisciplined and those who irritate us, is a great grace, a praiseworthy and manly thing. Some people live at peace with themselves and their fellow men, but others are never at peace with themselves, nor do they bring it to anyone else. These latter are a burden to everyone, but they are more of a burden to themselves. A few finally live at peace with themselves and try to restore it to others. Now all our peace in this miserable life is found in humbly enduring suffering rather than being free from it. So I think that if we're in that sort of circumstance, whether it's for 5 hours on an airplane or whether it's for, you know, 40 years in a marriage, or whether it's for 5 years in a brahmachari ashram, whatever it may be, that we can say, all right, if I'm in a situation that I can't change, what is Krishna and Guru, what are they asking me to do in this situation? How are they asking me to change? You know, as a Gurukul teacher, I often had students that were not congenial. They didn't match my mentality. They were there because their parents told them to go to school. It's not that they specifically wanted to be there. And in order to be a teacher to those students, I had to develop qualities and behaviors in myself that were lacking. And had I been in only congenial association, I never would have developed those qualities and those behaviors. In fact, I wouldn't even have known that I lacked them. So we can take these sort of situations as that opportunity. At the same time, we should look for compatible association. And if you can't find it locally, physically, take advantage of Kali Yuga's technology and find it virtually. I mean, I'm very blessed that I'm participating in several sanghas of devotees electronically, some of which I've been associated with for 25 years. And some of these sanghas, we've never all been physically in the same room at the same time. Just like I'm an associate editor for Back to Godhead since 1990, there's never been a situation where all of us editors have sat physically in the same room. In fact, some of them I've never met at all. But this sangha of devotees has nourished me in my service in so many ways. And there's been times when it was my main nourishment, you know. And I'm, as I said, I'm a member of various virtual groups of devotees, which nourish me very much. And then, of course, we have the shastras, and we may find that certain of the acharyas, certain personalities in the shastras are particularly compatible with us and particularly nourish us. So we can find it there. And if we have that, we'll also find it easier to tolerate people in our physical environment who are not compatible. Certainly, if there's people in our physical environment who are not compatible with us, we should not engage in intimate, loving exchanges with them. But we can see, well, why has Krishna brought this person into my life? A final point I'd like to make is that things change. Things change. There's been devotees in my life with whom we were bitter enemies. I mean, really bitter enemies. There's been members of the Hare Krishna movement where that person and myself were such bitter enemies that if we were at the same temple, you know, one of us would walk around to another door to avoid seeing each other. And now we're good friends. I mean, I can think of at least two cases like that. People where it's just, you know, complete enmity that turned into a not only a friendship, but a working friendship and doing service together and so forth. So things shift. People that we're incompatible with now, as we progress in Krishna consciousness and as they progress in Krishna consciousness, may change. And the opposite may happen also. There may be a person that we're compatible with at a certain stage, and then we move in different directions, or they, you know, they have some difficulty, or we have some difficulty. These things are very fluid. But as far as what's within our power, this is a principle of accepting what's favorable and rejecting what's unfavorable. This is as according to what is in our power to do. I think the most extreme example of unfavorable association was what was experienced by the devotees in the former Soviet Union when they were put into prison. So when they were put into prison, that wasn't just, you know, unfavorable devotees, but they were put into prison with criminals, and some of the most heinous criminals. And still, they made nice advancement in Krishna consciousness. I mean, it made a wonderful advancement. We read about how Satchisucha Prabhu gave up his body in a Soviet Siberian labor camp where he's surrounded by, you know, rapists and murderers and child molesters and robbers, etc. There's no proper prasadam, there's no deities, there's no holy place. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with the story. I've told it many times before, but there he was. He had gotten very ill from living on only bread and salt for 2 years. And he was in the infirmary, where, of course, he didn't receive much medical care. And this story was heard later from another prisoner who shared the infirmary room with him. So one day, Satchisucha, actually, he got out of bed. He had been just lying in bed for days. And he took a shower, and he asked the other prisoner to shave his head and leave a sika. He used some toothpaste to put on Tilak. He took one of the magazines and made it into a garland and put it around his neck. He took the sheet from the bed and wrapped it around himself like a dhoti and sat in the middle of the room cross-legged chanting Hare Krishna. And the other prisoner went for some medical treatment, and when he came back, Satchisucha was still sitting up in that position with a smile on his face, but it was only the body was there and gone. And that was with no congenial association on the external physical platform. I hope that answers your question.
Answered and beyond. Thank you so much.
Can I make a quick comment?
Yes.
I think that you should write a book, a compilation of all these Christian writers. I was raised a Roman Catholic, and I never was exposed to this. Of course, you know, I left when I was a teenager, but anyway. The quotes that you pull out, that you present, are absolutely astonishing. They're Vaishnava philosophy that I was never exposed to, personally.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating? I mean, I think a similar situation is there. I was raised in the Jewish faith. I studied at the Jewish Theological Seminary, and I was never exposed either to the side of Judaism that really goes deep into spiritual life. I think what happens is that religion starts to become more and more karmakanda, and it starts to become more and more just palatable to the masses who want bhakti and mukti. And this happens in every religion, that it becomes, you know, a dharma. Dharma becomes a dharma and has to be reinstated as dharma. But one will find in any bona fide religious tradition, and there's a devotee who recently compiled a book about Muslims who were actually Vaishnavas. So in any genuine religious tradition, you will find people who are truly saintly persons and who just say astonishing things. And many times, you know, things that echo our Vaishnav saints and may also be of help to us in our particular service. So there's a few, and it's interesting to me. You know, one of the reasons I joined Krishna Consciousness Movement was because Srila Prabhupada did always preach in a non-sectarian way. Srila Prabhupada never said that only people who are, you know, Vaishnavas or Gaudiya Vaishnavas or my disciples are going to attain to the spiritual world. He never said that. Never said that. He said, you know, if you love God, if you follow any bona fide guru and you love God, then you will attain to Krishna consciousness. And the problem is that in most religious traditions of the world at the present time in 2015, these higher truths are hidden from the people in general. I mean, when Devi Das Janavi Harrison from London recommended that I read St. Teresa of Avila's book on the interior mansions, I read it and I thought, how is it that Catholics aren't talking about this? And I thought, this must be required reading for the priests and monks, but they probably don't really understand it. And the same is with the Song of Solomon saying in the Old Testament. It just bewilders the modern practitioners. I believe also that by following the Sadachar that Srila Prabhupada has given us, then we can look at these other traditions and see what they're really saying. Whereas the people who are in these traditions today, especially if they're eating meat, fish, and eggs, taking intoxication, having illicit sex, gambling, if they're doing these things, they can't even understand their own tradition. They don't. They read what's in the scriptures, they read what's from their saintly persons, but they don't really hear it. They hear it in another way, and they end up preaching something quite different. So this is my experience, is that following Prabhupada's program has made me more aware, more attuned to what's really being said in the scriptures of the world. But I don't know if I'll ever compile that book, because I have a lot of publishing things on my table, and I've long ago passed the midpoint on this particular life's journey, so I don't know. There has to be somebody to do that. Anybody else have another question or comment?
Just, you know, St. Teresa was part of the Carmelite order. They're vegetarians.
Yes.
The Benedictine ones, the strict ones, they're vegetarian. The Franciscans, they're vegetarian. Now, that just gets airplay. You know, and then there are the remnants for the mass Catholics is Friday. When I was growing up, was fish day. You're not supposed to eat meat on Friday, so the compromise was fish. But actually, I don't get it that, you know, that most of the saints in the Catholic tradition were vegetarian.
Right.
And, you know, and people just don't get it.
No, they don't get it. Well, it's just like in the Jewish tradition, where it says directly in the Bible, don't eat the meat from the animal from which you take the milk. You know? If you're taking milk from a cow, you can't kill a cow. And what they take that to mean is don't mix milk and meat in your stomach. That's how they understand it. So they say you have to have a separation of at least 6 hours between eating something dairy and eating something meat. Yeah, you know?
It's crazy.
They take it to, and then they have all these detailed rituals for separating meat and dairy. You know, different dishes and different pots and different sponges and different dishwashing detergent, and unbelievably, you practically have two different kitchens. And the whole point was don't eat the cow. So yeah, these things become perverted. They become twisted, and they become twisted very fast. And such things have happened in our Vaishnava tradition, you know. Meditating on the associates of Vrindavan and following in their footsteps starts getting translated to men dressing up like gopis. You know, and having Rasa Leela with other men's wives and saying that they're Krishna. And it's so that it's, these things get changed very quickly. I mean, we have people right now in the Krishna Consciousness Movement who thinks that what Krishna Consciousness is all about is that the men should be controlling the women. And that's the essence of Krishna consciousness. It's like, excuse me? You know? So people will take something, they change the emphasis, they twist it, etc., in order to just justify their own you know, point. So the fact that women should be protected by men, that's a fact, but that's not the essence of our siddhanta.
Right.
You know, that's not the most important thing that we're supposed to be preaching in the world. But there's become like a subgroup of devotees who've made that their main thing. And then everything becomes lost. And then again, some acharya has to come and reinstate everything, and you know, or empty rituals. I mean, I grew up in Judaism where once a week the woman would light candles and have some kind of offering of a lamp, and then take the lamp, run her hand over the flame, and touch her hand to her head. But if anybody says, "Well, what does this ritual mean?" Nobody gives you an answer. Or they would, you know, make some bread, cover it with a cloth, put it on a silver plate, hold it up in the air, uncover the cloth, say some prayers, and then give everybody a piece of the bread. What are they doing? They're offering food and distributing prasadam. But they haven't a clue. And the same with the communion in Christianity. You know, what is it? It's offering food and distributing prasadam. But they twist it into something strange. So, and what's really sad is that people like St. Teresa of Avila and people like St. John of the Cross and St. Francis actually got persecuted. I mean, it wasn't just that they were marginalized and distorted, but they were persecuted. I mean, you have these guys who were tortured and killed by the church. And later on, you know, 100, 200 years later, they're canonized by the very same church. I mean, it's interesting also in Judaism, during the time, again, of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which is interestingly enough when St. Teresa and St. John also lived, but during the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in Judaism, there was a leader called the Baal Shem Tov, which means the keeper of the good name. And his main way of worship was to take his followers out into the streets, into public, with musical instruments, and to sing the holy names of the Lord. And he really started a whole personalistic movement within Judaism, that God was a person. Unfortunately, the philosophy of Maimonides, the Ramban, who was like kind of like the Sankaracharya of Judaism, became dominant. And so the whole Bible was reinterpreted impersonally. You know, God wrote on the tablets of stone with his finger. Well, he doesn't really have a finger. You know, it's just a metaphor and like that. Everything becomes distorted. We can take it as a given that Chaitanya Vaishnavism, Gaudiya Vaishnavism, has been distorted many, many times. It's being distorted now by various groups. It will be distorted in the future. There's no question that just because you have the pure thing, that it stays like that. It's already happening, and it has to be a periodic Yudayudaki bonus. It has to be Sridhanakam, that Krishna and his associates appear again to bring it back. And at least there should be enough, a critical mass of persons on the earth at any one time that are teaching the real thing, which is Mangmana Bhava Madhvato Majadunam. We could take one more question or comment. Thank you very much, Peter.
Just one last thing. You know, sincerity is, you know, in devotion, as they surrender to me, I reward them accordingly. There's a pilgrim, the Pilgrim's Way. It's a Russian monk who's praying unceasingly, rules for chanting Jesus prayer, very similar to, you know, what we've been given, you know, if you look at it, and they rely on the advices of the saints. So this sincerity is the thread. If you're sincere, you'll find other sincere people, even in another tradition.
Yes, yes, yes. And this one person posted a question here. I've been told that to attain the highest spiritual perfection, the only way to do it is through Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Is that correct? No, that's sectarianism. What did Jesus say? Ask and you will find. Right? Ask and you'll be answered. Seek and you shall find. Knock and the door shall be opened to you. Please believe me, there are many people who are currently, apparently in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, that are Kali Chela. There are, just like there are demons who enter into Vrindavan Leela. And there are people in other traditions who in their sincerity are being taken to the highest truth. Don't we think that Jesus can take people to Goloka Vrindavan? Of course he can. Now that's not going to be the experience, unfortunately, for most Christians or most Jews or most Muslims. Whereas I think I can say that most people following Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, most people following them will eventually, if not in this life, in another life, attain to Goloka Vrindavan. I don't think we can say the same thing about those in other traditions, but it's certainly available. Krishna never denies himself to a sincere soul. And as long as you're following a pure devotee, then that pure devotee can connect you with Krishna. And can connect you with Krishna in any situation. I mean, why do I personally follow Gaudiya Vaishnavism? Because it's so much easier here. I mean, I'm not going to intentionally check myself into a Siberian labor camp. You know, if Krishna puts you there, you can still become Krishna conscious, but we should seek out the best and most compatible association that we're able to. So if we want to attain to Goloka, associate with other people who want to attain to Goloka. That just makes common sense. You know, and if you don't know and you don't have that access, but you're a sincere Muslim, you're a sincere Jew, you're a sincere Buddhist even. I mean, Buddha is also one of the incarnations. Even if you're a sincere Buddhist and you're praying to Buddha, can't Buddha reveal to you? Will that be accomplished in this life or another life? I don't know. That's individual. We can't even say everybody following Srila Prabhupada is going to attain perfection in this life. Hare Krishna. So, I mean, I know a devotee who has a spontaneous remembrance of another life as a Buddhist. She remembers being a Buddhist who died at the steps of a temple, wishing that she in another life also could live as a Buddhist monk in that temple. And she was telling me, she said, now I'm living in the temple ashram, and this is the, you know, in an ISKCON temple, and this is the result of my desire in a previous life in Buddhism. And through my devotion to Buddha, I've been brought to Krishna consciousness. So that's our philosophy. That's what Srila Prabhupada would say all the time. Krishna is always there for the sincere souls. You know, always. But yeah, I mean, come on. In Gaudiya Vaishnavism, it's so much easier. Everyone's going to be talking about Krishna and Radha and Krishna and the Cowherd Boys and Madhya Yasoda. We have all the Goswami literature. We have the express train. We have the train, you know, that doesn't make any stops. Yeah, you can jump out the window if you want, but this train goes straight to the destination. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.